right, Simon Hayes, welcome to the Hear Us Out podcast. We are thrilled to have you joining us today. Somebody with your professional experience and acclaim, you've earned Academy Awards on Les Mis in 2013, among many other prestigious awards. But most recently, you've been a part of Wicked. And since you are no stranger to large-scale productions, why don't you tell us what it's been like being a part of Wicked?
Eric, Michelle, thank you very much for inviting me on. I'm really excited to be here and talk to your listeners. Wicked was an incredible opportunity for me to really dig deep into recording live vocals on a huge movie set. I've always been a fan of Wicked, and I know that it's a very emotional experience for people that have seen it in the theatre. And I was excited to be able to translate that onto the big screen, with obviously helping John Chu and Alice Brooks, the DP, and using live vocals, which obviously isn't the norm in movie musicals. That's what I like to do. That's where I feel the real emotions and the real truth of the performance are. But being able to do that on such a huge movie set had big challenges.
Now, when I think of Wicked, I think mainly of the two original leads, Kristen Chenoweth, Idina Menzel. And now we have these two brand new leads, Ariana Grande, Cynthia Erivo. How did you envision for them to make this their leads their own in their own way, to be known for these roles?
What I wanted to do was be able to record their original performances on the set in a really authentic way that didn't rely on pre-recorded vocals and didn't rely on re-recorded vocals. And what I think that gave our actors the opportunity to do was to riff with the singing and come out of singing and into dialogue and back into singing whenever they wanted to. When we have a transition from dialogue into singing in an old school musical fashion, it's kind of like the audience go, uh-oh, here comes the lip sync. And the actors don't have the ability to drift in and out organically as they feel their emotions should be able to drive them to. By recording their singing live on Wicked, the same way as the actors in the stage show would be able to do, it meant that they could play with their vocals, they could play with the way that they were singing, and just basically weave an in and out of dialogue and singing to their heart's content. That was what I wanted to be able to deliver.
I have followed Ariana Grande since her very early singing days back on Nickelodeon. And a problem I've seen for when she would sing with other actors or actresses is that whoever was mixing the sound at those times didn't quite capture her voice, where she would kind of be drowned out by the other singer. And how did you ensure that both leads were equally as loud, equally as strong? I would actually say, having seen the movie, I saw it about a week or two ago, and my favorite point in the whole movie was during the song, "What Is This Feeling?" because you were able to capture both of their vocals so cleanly and so strongly that I didn't feel like one was overpowering the other. How'd you do it?
Well, before we go any further, I've got to tell you that those actors knew how to sing together. And there was something that happened on the set that was quite magical that none of us saw coming. And that is, their vocals just work. And they're also such fantastic singers that they were able to use their own volumes in a really, really sensitive way to be able to support the other person. That doesn't always happen. It was almost like when we heard them sing together, it was like almost like, oh my God, were these two born to sing together? And Cynthia, who can go extremely loud when she wants to, whenever she sung with Ari, she was extremely collaborative and sensitive in the way that she used her vocal opposite Ari. And so I've got to say, before I take credit for sound mixing skills or miking skills, the huge credit actually goes to the way that those two collaborated and used their voices and almost sung as one. They were very, very aware of what they were doing and how they sounded together. And as I say, that doesn't always happen. There was just kind of this organic instinct that they had when they started singing together that we saw happen on the stage. And it was just very, very sensitive. If we want to go into the technical side of how we did it, of course, Ari had two microphones on her. So did Cynthia. They also had their own boom microphones. And so what we were able to do to a certain extent was be able to do a blend where we could minutely turn one of them up and one of them down in the final mix. However, had they not have been singing collaboratively and sensitively together, that wouldn't have been possible. Because what I didn't do, which is something that would happen in a recording studio, I didn't ask either of them to mime when the other person was on camera singing. Because although you get, if you like, a more polished vocal that way and the ability to completely blend afterwards, what you lose is a bit of emotion, particularly because for the first 50% of the movie, they're singing at each other like they don't like each other, they hate each other, and then they start singing as they become friends. And so there is always a narrative in the way that they sing to each other that is important for the emotion. And to say to, for instance, Cynthia, don't sing on Ari's close-up would have removed Ari's ability to emotionally sing back to Cynthia. And so that's something that John Chu, Cynthia and Ari didn't want to do. And I didn't want to do it either, because what I want to do is I want to focus on the emotions of what the cinema audience are feeling and the way that you guys connect with the story. And I feel that if we try and create such a pristine recording that we draw the emotions from that recording, then we've actually gone too far. And the technical side of things has become prioritized over the creative side of things. And that is always a fine balance. And we never want to step over that line.
You know, as you were talking about the fact that Wicked existed as a musical on stage prior to this, does it put any degree of pressure or alter the way you need to look at what your role is because these songs exist already, because the public has a conception of what the song sounds like? Does that impact how you go about your work, or is it just, hey, we're going to do what we do and we hope that conveys to the public?
No, I think that we have to have an incredible, and I know, here's the thing, the question really that you're asking is a John Chu question. And what I can tell you, having been stood next to John Chu for 18 months while we made this movie, is that he had and has an incredible respect for the stage show, the original score, and the rhythm of Wicked. The conversation that kept on coming up on the set was about the tempo and the rhythm of Wicked and how it pulls the heartstrings. And we knew that we could deviate very slightly in certain places, but we knew in other places that we absolutely couldn't. And I think that John Chu's skill as a director was knowing where that balance is, knowing where we could potentially, for instance, let me give you an example. At the beginning of I'm Not That Girl, Cynthia was singing freestyle to a keyboard. She wasn't singing to a backing track. She wanted to use her own tempo and let her movement and her emotion and her, the way that the camera was working with her, drive the tempo of the way that she was singing. But then at a certain point, we knew that we couldn't do the whole song like that because I'm Not That Girl has a tempo. So around about the end of the first verse, we blended across in her IEM from live keyboard into pre-recorded music, which has that lifeblood of Wicked, which is the rhythm of the track. And so we did allow the acting to dictate the pace for the first verse. And then when we get into it and the bass line comes in and the song starts blooming, we then go into the version of I'm Not That Girl that all of the theatre audience know and love. And so that was a really good example of Cynthia and John actually knowing where they could deviate, and me being a support and being able to achieve that technically and get those vocal recordings and be able to liaise and get that blend, that very sensitive blend across at a certain point from live keyboard accompanying Cynthia into the pre-recorded track.
I'm happy you brought up the IEMs in your monitors, because that was a part of this conversation I was really looking forward to. We do a lot of work with stage musicians with in-ear monitors, and there are so oftentimes complaints about them that the musician will feel isolated from the audience because of the isolation that the in-ear monitor creates, or
right.
the mix. If you're a guitar player who's going to be working into a lead, into a solo in a song, are you getting too much bass? Are you getting too much of the drums? Is the mix working for what you need in that moment? Which is part of why you see musicians pulling out a monitor in the midst of a performance. How did you go about the process of utilizing in-ears, and had you had any formal education on what is needed within an in-ear to accomplish what you're trying to accomplish with Wicked?
Well, Eric, that's a really, really great question. And it's going to be quite a long and detailed answer.
That's great.
We're here for it.
As you know, my first completely live musical was Les Miserables. Mm-hmm. And the IEM strategy that we used on Les Mis was slightly different for a couple of reasons. The first reason was because we were not orchestrating any of Les Mis. We didn't have any backing tracks whatsoever pre-recorded. Tom Hooper allowed his cast to completely set their own tempo on that movie. What that meant was that we were only playing a keyboard into their IEMs. And that subsequently meant that we could use earwigs, which are not great sounding. The reason why we used earwigs on Les Mis is because you don't have to paint out cables. You can't see what your viewers can probably see here, which is my IEM and the cable coming out. On Les Mis, the first thing was we didn't have the same kind of budget for Wicked. And the other thing was it was 12 years ago and visual effects at that point were more expensive. Every year that passes, VFX in films become more financially viable and the VFX teams become better at delivering great VFX at a more cost-effective price. So on Les Mis, we were using earwigs, but we got away with it because the electronic keyboard is very mid-range sounding. It doesn't have extremes of bass. It doesn't have extremes of top end. And it also doesn't have a complex mix attached to it because it's just one musical instrument. So it was great and it worked. When we came into Wicked, one of the big differences that I knew right from the start was that earwigs were not going to cut it. One of the reasons they weren't going to cut it is because we were generally, for let's say 85% of the performances, we were generally locked to a backing track to respect this lifeblood of the rhythm of Wicked. And that backing track had been produced as an instrumental by Greg Wells. And Greg Wells, fantastic producer, is very, very well known for the percussion, the bass, and the top end of his recordings. Mm-hmm. And so to give one of our cast a very mid-rangey sounding earwig just wouldn't have done Greg Wells's mix any justice. And it actually would have confused the hell out of the IEM, which really wants to hear something, let's say, from 350 hertz up to 2 kilohertz. There's nothing down deep and there's nothing up top. So that was the first reason why we needed to go onto full range IEMs. Mm-hmm. The other reason why we needed to go onto full range IEMs is because both Cynthia and Ariana are used to full range IEMs. And it would have been such a huge step down for them to be asked to listen to earwigs, because they have spent their careers listening to really high quality IEMs, mm-hmm. Both on the stage and in their music careers. And so what we did was we spoke to Pablo Hellman, our VFX supervisor, from the start and said, look, unfortunately, we're going to have to use IEMs. We're going to do our very best to hide the cables in the hair so that you don't see them. And what we actually did was we got our IEM manufacturer to skin tone match those IEMs. So Cynthia's were green, and they were painted exact. They were manufactured the same color as her green makeup, which Frances Hannon, the makeup supervisor, designed so fantastically. It's kind of like a translucent green, and Ari's were matched to Galinda's facial makeup color. What that meant was it meant on the very wide shots, we didn't need to paint them out because we did a good, or the hair and makeup department did a great job of hiding the cables. And because we weren't in tight, there was no need to paint out the IEMs. But on the mid shots and the close-ups, Pablo Herman, the VFX supervisor, and his team removed them. And what that meant was it meant that we could give Cynthia, Ariana, Jonathan Bailey, and Jeff Goldblum and Michelle Yeoh their own mix in triple driver IEMs. And, you know, they were high quality IEMs, and we didn't spare any expense or size. We went for something the same size. In fact, I'm wearing the same manufacturer's IEM right now, and I'm wearing triple drivers, which of course, as your listeners know, means that the top end and the base are just as well presented as the mid-range.
I like that you bring up the idea of triple drivers, because IEMs can go out to 12 drivers, some manufacturers even more, and that actually can pose its own set of problems when it comes to getting a proper sound mix. So for many, many performers, a sweet spot can be 2 to 4 drivers within the IEM, and more drivers does not necessarily translate to better sound quality or an easier mix for the sound production end. Where was it that you learned 3 was the way to go for this type of production?
Eric, here's the thing. To be completely and utterly frank with you, I tested the twin driver and I tested the triple driver, and I couldn't hear the difference between the two on the type of music that we were listening to. I couldn't hear the difference, and I was going to go double driver, but then me and my team sat down and we had a look at the size of the twin driver versus the size of the triple driver, and they were exactly the same size. The triple driver wasn't protruding out of the ear canal any further than the dual driver. It was the same size device. And so I just thought to myself, you know what? Although I can't ascertain which one sounds better out of the two, I'm just going to go for the triple because I know potentially that it's going to be 5 to 10% better on some tracks. And perhaps I just haven't found the track where I can hear the difference. But what I would say is I think that a twin driver and a triple driver is very, very close. I don't think you need more than 3 drivers. I think that that could be overcomplicating the crossover within the IEM itself and giving the crossover too much work to do. I think sometimes less is more. But what I would say about a single driver is, even if it's a really great single driver, I question whether we're going to hear the hi-hats and the bass guitar and the sub-bass frequencies as well as a double or a triple driver. So I think the sweet spot is double or triple. And we went for triple because the manufacturer which we were using just said, look, this is our best product.
I love hearing you say this because it is not a conversation that's had enough out in the sound world, that somebody of your experience and talent level can recognize that there's diminishing to no returns on all those additional drivers. Because conversations we've had with stage musicians, it's my sound engineer spoke to the company, this is what the company recommended. And far too often the companies are saying, this is our best model, it has 12 drivers, buy this. And it's not actually helping the musicians. And in some cases it's hindering it. So it's great to hear what you're saying, because it validates what we on the audiological end thought we knew, that some of this stuff is just unnecessary and creates problems. And your experience is validating what we've kind of thought all along when it comes to the in-ears.
I'd like to circle back to something else that you mentioned when you asked me that question, and that is how the actors dealt with being removed from their fellow cast members. Because actually, in film, we work in what I think could be quite unique. And what we do on film sets is we always offer two drivers, but we advise, sorry, two units left and right, but we advise only using one. And that's because our actors are generally going to be moving from a dialogue scene directly into a music scene and then back into dialogue whenever they want to. And they need to be aware of their surroundings. They need to be aware not just of their fellow cast members, but they need to have a situational awareness of where the camera is. If we've got a camera on a crane, not just for safety, but just so that they know where their mark is and where they should be best presenting their face for the camera that is potentially coming up on their shoulder. And that situational awareness can really be diminished if they put two IEMs in left and right. Because remember that the microphone that they're hearing through their IEM is their personal microphone. And my job, well, they're wearing two personal microphones, and we'll get into that later, but I'm generally putting one or the other through their IEM so they can hear themselves. And I'm putting a blend of their other fellow cast members through those IEMs as well. But those microphones that I'm putting on the actors, I'm also trying to do something else very specific with them. I'm trying to reduce background noise as much as possible and only picking up the vocal. Now, that is a conflict of interest because if I'm trying to remove as much background noise as possible, I'm also removing any situational awareness from what they can hear. And so if they put both left and right in, they're often not aware of exactly what's going on around them, which is why I think it's always quite dangerous for cyclists and motorcycle riders to be wearing two IEMs, right? That's obviously a different conversation, but that's very much my mantra. And so what both Ari and Cynthia and Jeff and Johnny and Michelle did was only use one IEM at all times. And by the way, during rehearsals, we tried both. And just from a playfulness of them saying, well, look, let's do a take and just try both. And everyone very quickly said, Nat, I just want to go with one. And generally, our cast, rather than saying, let's use the one that is best for camera, we
That
didn't
was my
do
next
that.
question.
We didn't do that. What we did, we found that they preferred, and what was better for their performance was that they would have one ear that there was their preference for leaving open for their situational awareness, and their other ear would be their preference for hearing the instrumental backing track and their own voice that they're singing to.
Interesting. I wonder if it had anything to, there's crossover within the brain when it comes to hearing. And a lot of times that can be related to handedness in terms of what your ear will prefer to do. I'm curious if there was any relation to if whether they were right-handed or left-handed and which monitor they wanted out, but that's another conversation.
That's a great question, and I wish I knew because I know that I can't remember who did what because I didn't put the IEMs in, one of my assistants did. But I know that Ari had one choice and Cynthia's was the other choice, for instance. They
Interesting.
didn't both wear them in the same ear.
Interesting.
And what I can tell you also is that we gave each one of those actors mentioned their own personal mix. They weren't getting a global mix. And so Ari's preference of reverb was one level, and Cynthia had her own preference, and that's what we would that would be our starting point on each track, and we would then vary during a sound check. We would very minutely control and detail in home in on exactly what the correct reverb was for that singing volume and that backing track. But we had a starting point that was Cynthia's preferred and a starting point that was Ari's preferred, which I'm assuming was probably what they like when they're doing a music show. And we also gave them the choice of how much they would like to hear their fellow cast members. And so they basically had a personal mix.
Before Michelle gets to her next question, what I'm hearing from you is that so many of the complaints that stage musicians have, you all are accounting for on set, that the individual actor is getting the mix and the blend that they need and they prefer. And also because you're not working in a loud environment like a arena concert, we're not so worried about the sound exposure. So utilizing just one ear is not a problem. So,
Right.
hearing how this is done, it's fascinating how these devices can be used in multiple settings in very different ways to achieve what's needed for the performers.
Yes, exactly. But here's another interesting thing, which we found. Ari, when we w sometimes we used a click if we were really locked to a rhythm, and we just needed to within that track to, if you like, cement that rhythm and support that rhythm, we would put the click track in to help. And what Ari, the frequency Ari liked her click track at was completely different to the frequency that Cynthia liked her click track at. And so these are differences in the way that we hear as human beings, and they're differences also in the way that our brains process, what is the best frequency to ascertain amongst a very detailed mix where that lock is, what we like to hear. And we tried a few different clicks with each of our actors and let them have the choice about which one would be their primary.
Now, Ariana, Cynthia, Jonathan, they all come from very different musical backgrounds. Did you have any specific direction or guidance that you wanted for them to cater their voices specifically for this medium, for their different environments they were in, to adapt their voices from what they're used to?
No, I didn't. And I would say that my primary role is to capture the emotions of the live performance and to have as little input on that live performance as possible. I'm not someone who is there to try and influence the way that they perform. Now, that's not to say that they didn't have voice coaches. That's not to say, and I know from listening to Ari's interviews that she changed the way she sung to be Galinda, and she that she basically became more operatic in her delivery. But that is certainly not something that falls under my MO on a movie set. I'm there to support them creatively and give them no technical restrictions or boundaries whatsoever. What I want to be able to say to those actors is, yes, whatever you need, I can do that, so that they don't have anything to worry about technically, and they can immerse themselves creatively in their performance rather than saying, oh, hang on a second, I just want that to be locked in and for them to feel like they are wrapped in a comfort blanket and they can just become Elphaba and Galinda and not have to worry about what they're hearing in their IEM.
What a great way to go about it, for them to just be able to, as you said, immerse themselves in it.
Yeah.
And you had something that Cynthia certainly made known is that she wanted to do her own stunts. So she's going off in the air for Defying Gravity. You have Ariana shimmying across the floor in Popular, and Jonathan is bouncing on books. And I assume that creates just a lot of noise, environmental noise around them. How do you clean that out and smooth it, but
Okay,
also
so
capture it for where, for how they're moving?
that's a really great question, Michelle, because again, like potentially asking an actor to mime when the other actor's singing on a close-up, I don't want to do anything that starts detracting from their performance. So like when Johnny kicks that book and you hear that real book land. That wasn't a sound effect, that was the real book landing. And the film production sound mixer in me wanted to say, hey, Johnny, can you time that kick so that it lands between the words so that we can get rid of it? But I very quickly had a word with myself and said, Simon, don't you dare ask that, because then Johnny's going to be concentrating on when he kicks the book rather than just being in the flow of the performance. And so what I do is I try and leave the solo singer alone and just let them act and be that character. But what I do is, for instance, as soon as the cameras start going in tighter, I will be running onto set in between takes and saying to Chris Scott, our fantastic choreographer, Chris, those seven dancers on the left and those eight dancers on the right, now we've gone in tighter, we can't see them. Can we relax them and lose their footfall? The other thing that I'll be doing is the moment the cameras move in tight and we don't see anyone's feet, my team will quickly be running in with rubber-backed carpet and carpeting everything. And so although I'm not asking anyone to act to change their performance for me, what I'm doing is finely tuning and making sure that anything that is not on screen, I remove. And what that does is, that's almost, if you like, our primary route of noise reduction. Because if I can reduce it in the real world, it means that Nancy Nugent Title, who cleans up my vocals and dialogue, is going to have less work to do on plugins. And the less work we do on plugins, the better, because the purer the vocal is that the audience hear in the cinema. And there is something, I think, when we start to overuse plugins, whether we're talking about in a pop record or whether we're talking about in a cinema vocal, if we start to overuse digital plugins, we start to minutely drag the audience away from the truth of the performance. And so what I'm trying to do is to remove as much background noise as I possibly can without affecting that performance, so that Nancy can use those plugins in an extremely sensitive and minute way, rather than having to hit them quite hard in post-production.
So you're just talking about the action of kicking the book, and this is the real sound, it's the actual sound that's occurring on set. I'm thinking about, having listened to you talk about the creation of the wind within the set, that the special piping was created to bring the wind without bringing the mechanical sound that's creating the wind. The air of the wind is still going to, I would think, make some noise over the microphones as the air passes by. Is that something you're trying to further control, or is having that along with the vocal giving a degree of authenticity because it's giving the listener the sound of what they're seeing?
There's a couple of things. It's so nice talking to you guys, because you're fellow sound people, and I recognize you're asking all the right questions.